Why am I inflicting all this stuff on you? Right at the end. No, but that's another image, another snake image. So you can do stuff with on your own with that if you want to. Lots more images, some which we can look at tomorrow. But why Egypt, and why have I brought us to here right at the end? Whatever, it's because I have, you know. It's what's happened. So that's one. That's definitely one answer, right? That's one of the reasons. But to come back to our topic about the imaginal, ancient Egypt is very unusual and interesting because it's like a time capsule. This was a civilization that had enormous stability, went on for about 5,000 years, and its vision of the sacred was completely connected with embodiment and completely connected with the art of the living image. Every Egyptian temple had at its heart a living image who would be awakened in the morning, would move through the day, and would go to sleep at night. Every tomb in Egypt is filled with living images of the descent into the underworld and the ascent into the stars. So this was a people, you know, not a perfect civilization by any means, but this was a people who really understood and took very seriously the embodiment of the image. And their whole civilization is built on dualisms, and built on the paradox of opposites and on bringing opposites together. Right, so if you have it even in the landscape, you have the fertile Nile Valley, the black land, you have the infertile red desert just outside it, and so you have the world of the living which is within the black land, and you have the world of the dead in the red land, which is just over the mountains of the west. So you bury your dead in the west, the living live in the east. So most of the temples for the living are on the eastern side of the river. Temples for the dead are on the left-hand side of the river. So this whole civilization really works with opposites, and works with the capacity to bring images to life and to know the creativity of working with images. And it's like a time capsule, because all this got forgotten. It goes on. So this civilization, if you like, is still in existence in the Greco-Roman time, but gradually it gets forgotten about. Its temples get covered over. People forget how to read hieroglyphs, so nobody understands anymore what these signs mean. The Islam takes over that region. There's lots of interesting things going on in Islam, but it becomes this sort of these lost temples, lost tombs, lost language, and it sits there basically for a couple of thousand years, more or less, a little less probably.
How many years?
Well, accurate, it's hard to be accurate really, because people's knowledge is transmitted, but around about 2,000 years, you could say, really, from the kind of early Christian era. By the time the early Christian era has come about, knowledge of hieroglyphs has been forgotten, and doesn't get rediscovered again until the 19th century, when people like Masparo and Champollion discover how to start decoding the hieroglyphs. And And so what happens is we suddenly, this is why you get Egyptmania in the 19th century, you know, it becomes, Tutankhamun's tomb becomes discovered in the early 20th century, which adds to this, you know, so you get this whole kind of, and Egypt is known, all the centuries, Egypt, you find in the Greek writings and the sort of Roman writings, that Egypt is the source of magic. This is where the great magicians are found. And in a way, what they're saying is these are the great masters and mistresses of the living image. These are the people who can really work with the deep energies of life. And time and time again, you get Neoplatonic writers saying, we hear people like Iamblichus the Syrian talking about the art of ensouling the image and saying that we have lost the great methods. These are because these belonged, in a sense, to this earlier civilization. And so, you know, fast forward 20th century, Howard Carter, Tutankhamun, whose proper pronunciation is Tutankhamun, not Tutankhamun. Tutankhamun. Tut, whose life is held in Amun. Ankh is the word meaning life, Amun meaning the god Amun. And who was previously called Tutankhaton, because his father was Akhenaton, the heretic pharaoh. Akhenaton, religious visionary and fascist, nearly destroys Egypt by imposing the rule of the one god and dismisses the many gods. Moves out of Thebes, moves out right into a place called Tel El Amarna, creates a great new visionary city, spends fucking fortune on it, and bankrupts Egypt. Fortunately, he doesn't live very long, because, you know, we possibly think he was assassinated. And then the ancient tradition gets put back in place, and this is at the end of the Middle Kingdom, at the rise of the New Kingdom. And what happens at that point is a great resurgence of Egyptian civilization. It's before Ramses II. It's the time when Egypt becomes this great power in the Middle East. So one of the things that happens is you get this huge religious transformation in Egypt, where in the New Kingdom you get these amazing tombs being built in the Valley of the Kings. And you get these things that are called the Books of the Netherworld, of which the Book of Gates is one of the principal ones. And these are, you know, what happened at the Akhenaten time is a bit inconceivable for us. You've imagined a civilization that at that point had gone on, had been in existence 2,000 years, had a stable religious, stable system. Imagine the chaos of that all being swept away. And the monotheism that actually was based around worship the king and the king worships the god, everybody has to do what I say, or die. Akhenaten, actually in the 19th century and early 20th century, had a great press. People talked of him as the first monotheist and was trying to introduce a new and an evolved religion to the primitive Egyptians, and they couldn't handle it, so they murder the enlightened ruler and they go back to their primitive superstitions of all these weird images. So that would have been the 19th century Egyptologist take on Akhenaten. He was a great figure. As we've understood this history, actually he destroyed the country. He was a kind of Trump figure.
So which god did he instate as the one god?
The Aten, the god Aten. It's an ancient sun god figure, but he said, I'm not having anything to do. He was an iconoclast, actually. I'm not having anything to do with images. We just have the image of the sun. And we don't want any of these murky, weird images with animals and kind of, and I am going to be the son of the sun, and everybody must worship the Aten. So now early on in his reign, he wasn't as fanatical, but later on he becomes very fanatical, and in the process nearly drives Egypt into destruction. What the priests of Amun do, is to create this, what they do is what they had never done before, is to write down, to create in papyri and to create in tombs sets of images, sets of structures that enable the ancient ways of understanding the living image to be recorded and found again if they get destroyed. So this is a kind of, a cultural, like collective unconscious movement in some way, where the if you like, the soul of a civilization has been under threat, has nearly been destroyed, because there's a whole period of about 30 years where it's hard to imagine, really. There's amazing, huge temples which throughout the land would have been silent, closed up under the order of the king. So a whole way of believing and thinking vanishes for several decades. So when it returns again, and it obviously was carried on in secret during the Akhenaten period, then the unconscious collective response is to ensure that it can never be forgotten again. So it's recorded in papyri, it's recorded in stone, in the tombs of the kings. It's recorded in Abydos, which is the great ancient spiritual center of Egypt. And the function of the Book of Gates, it's all the Netherworld books have similar functions, but the Book of Gates in particular is very useful. In it is a pretty much complete structure for really understanding how to work with the living image. There's masses in it. It really describes the, so we looked at last weekend, it describes the journey of the sun god into the underworld through the hours of the night, descending to the deepest part of the underworld, where the source of light and consciousness meets Osiris, the god of death, and life and death come together, and there is a sort of renewal that happens at that deepest point, which simultaneously is an immersion in the waters of life, which then leads to a process of ascension, of emergence, if you like, which leads to the new sun rising. Now, if you talk to an academic Egyptologist, he would say, that's what that's about, and then he would explain each one of the 12 hours to you very easily, that it would make sense, and that would be brilliant, and we'd all understand the books of the underworld, and that would be good. But of course it misses the major point that they're trying to get across, that actually the major thing, that what is being preserved here are living images that are meant to be looked at in the way that we've been looking at them, meant to be engaged with, so they come to life within us. And that as they come to life within us, they get recreated, they become present within us and present in the world. And we have to be very wary, in a way, of understanding here, because understanding only happens through participation. And what happens is, what you're invited to do in the Book of Gates is to accompany the god Amun in the sun bark, in the sunship. You accompany the generative source into the darkness. And as you are present in that generative source, in that place of awareness, you then keep noticing living images which you're intended to hang out with and be present with and befriend and find the meaning, internal meaning, not external meaning, so that little by little capacities wake up inside you, which are these very capacities of being able to work with the living image. And the intention, the underneath intention of them is that whoever you are and wherever you are, if you engage with these images, they will speak to some deep level of your own soul and bring you into relationship with the ensouled world. But what you have to do, of course, is make them your own. You have to allow, in the way that we have been doing, instead of thinking, okay, I wonder what the Egyptology could tell us about that. It can be helpful to know that sometimes, but mostly not, actually. You know, the it's the, what does this mean? Does this, you know, today it's talking to me about watering the garden. Right, now that sounds like a small thing, watering the garden, mm-hmm. until we realize that the irrigation of life is right at the heart of Egyptian tradition, but right, more than that, right at the heart of life. If we ever, if we do not water the garden, if we don't want, we don't water the garden, our own lives, things die. Right. So from that point of view, it is to treat whatever emerges as significant, and to hang out with it, and to let it, and to follow it, and to let it show us what is needed, really. And so what you have there is a book full of, packed full of images. An enormous resource pack, you could say. Okay, that from the work that we've already done, without me doing any teaching on the Book of Gates, you should be able just to hang out with it, little by little, puzzle with it, fight with it, engage with it, find your way through it all, and learn a lot about yourself and a lot about your inner capacities, because that's what it's designed to do. You may not get all the understanding an Egyptologist has, but that's not what we're doing here. We're not trying to become Egyptologists. We're not trying to become experts on Egypt. We're trying to understand our own relationship to the living image. The meaning is in the experience, so that as you look at, say, this image, you know, whatever happens in that moment, is that image speaking to you? Is that, there's that colloquy, that communion? Yeah, go.
Where they cause that permission to make it. That's real for me right now. And I think.
Yeah, good.
I think I've always had, well, of course, I've got right at it.
No, oh, that's right. Exactly.
I've done that so much, and it's really
right.
Hard to take that.
Yeah.
I mean, is it okay to me?
Yeah.
Permission.
That's right. That's exactly right. Right. So that's a really good example of that insight, something really shifting. And the usefulness of a book like that is that it's this huge compendium and structure. So it gives us an answer to, you know, what you're saying, Roberta, what help do we need? Well, something else gives us a structure. It gives us something to work with, something we can come back to over and over again in some ways, that we can kind of deepen into. The Jungian analyst Andreas Schweitzer talks about the Books of the Netherlands. He says this is humanity's first written down collective dream. Which is a really interesting way to look at it. So that if you engage with humanity's first collective dream, of course, then you're touching into the roots of being a human being. I'm just going to finish a second, we need to finish, but I just want to finish on one little anecdote. I had a really interesting experience with this book in last autumn. And again, it's one of these weird synchronous things. I was in the tomb of Seti I. And Andrew, Ali and I and some friends were in there. And the guy, the really lovely guys, was absolutely back of all about Egyptology. And we were a bit overwhelmed by it. And sort of, fuck, where are I? So I found myself just showing them. I was describing a passage through the gates and getting them. And actually, what I feel, I know this in retrospect, but actually what I did was an exercise with them like we've just done. I got them to visualize the feet of the gates and visualize the experience and the forms and sort of, not consciously, I wasn't really planning on doing it, it just happened. But it actually what happened there was quite extraordinary. I mean, they were really delighted and ran off telling everybody how wonderful I was, which was nice. That was nice for me, but actually, what was much more powerful was it was like the whole space came alive, because I was standing in the space, bringing myself and the others into the inner space, in a place that had been dedicated to that. And it was quite powerful for me now, even telling you about it, because suddenly it was like all these beings took notice of me. And I thought, oh, fuck, I didn't mean, oh my God. You know, so it was a very strong, very, very strong impact, and one of these weird synchronous things that I wasn't intending. So that's that strange thing that can happen to the left hand, really. It's suddenly you find yourself, and then you find yourself there for connecting to something, which is partly what I've been doing on and off since then. And why I've come to understand that the Egyptian stuff is kind of really kind of important, because it comes to us with a lot of, because we do not know the cultural context. It's really great that we don't know much about the cultural context, so the images can speak much more directly to us. Because we haven't got a Ronald Hutton telling us the context that's around it, right? So there's something really, really fresh and powerful about it, I think. And in a way, it's right that what Fern said earlier, that we are probably the first group in thousands of years who have sat with the particular nature of these images in this particular way. And that's kind of a bit amazing as well. And people individually, almost certainly, will have done this, but it isn't taught like this. I mean, if you enter on a course on the Book of Gates, people, you'd have a much more academic presentation on it, and sort of, whereas actually we're immersing ourselves in the images.
Ran a week in Luxor.
Yes. That's an amazing idea, actually. That would be something to think about.